Good morning, this is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. During this hour of Focus 580, we will talk with John Brady Keesling. He spent 2 decades as a diplomat in the U.S. State Department, representing American interests around the world. But in February 2003, he resigned in protest of the coming war in Iraq. He continues to speak around the country. He is writing a great deal, in fact, writing a book, and he was on the campus of the University of Illinois yesterday and continues here today, last night speaking in the Center for Advanced Study Millicom Lecture Series. Very well attended lecture last night, and also he will be speaking today at noon at the University YMCA, part of the Friday Forum Series at the University Y at 10001 South Wright Street in Champaign, and that's free and open to the public. So you should attend that. And also, we will be talking with him during this hour of Focus 580. If you want to join our conversation, you're welcome to do that. The phone number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. A bit more about our guest. Mr. Keesling served for 20 years as a foreign service officer in the U.S. Department of State. His postings included Morocco, Armenia, Israel, and Greece, and many other places. He is the recipient of the Rivkin Award given by the American Foreign Service Association for Constructive Dissent. He was also one of a member of a group of State Department officials that pushed for intervention in Bosnia. And as I say, he's visiting the campus, and we're glad to have him with us. John Brady Keesling, good morning.
Good morning, Jack. Thanks for having me here.
Well, thanks again for being here. I wonder if we could start by asking a question I'm sure you get all the time to start a conversation about this, is how you came to resign from the State Department in looking at what was going on with the coming war in Iraq.
First of all, being a diplomat is an amazing career. I spent 20 years and I loved all but the last couple. It's rare to have a job where the U.S. government pays you to go out and learn languages and find the most interesting people you can and talk to them, try to convince them of the U.S. government's position, but also try to figure out what makes them tick, what are the rules of their society, how can the United States get done what it needs to get done working with a foreign society, working with the rules of that society. It's a great intellectual challenge. It was a great personal fulfilling, great personal accomplishment just to be out there in the world. And the problem was that, for the first, say, 17 years of my career, the work I did, it was very clear to me that I was serving the interests of the American people. What we were doing was working out there on the front lines, making America a bit safer, a bit more prosperous. And then suddenly, with the administration of George W. Bush, American policy changed and American rhetoric changed. And, I serve the taxpayers, I serve the elected president, any diplomat does. I was speaking out now on behalf of policies that I thought intellectually made no sense, using rhetoric that, from watching the people I was talking to the foreigners, that rhetoric did not work with them. We had a policy that in the real world didn't do what America needed to get done. And this created for me a real intellectual and moral problem. And diplomats are also bureaucrats, and bureaucrats, they judge themselves by how well they fit into their bureaucracy. And for a while, I just sucked it up and did what we all do. But at a certain point, the gap between what I knew intellectually and what I was asked to do just became too large. And the result of that was I started to become dysfunctional as a diplomat. In September of 2002, it was obvious that we were going to war in Iraq. This was the dumbest thing imaginable. Anyone who knew about the Middle East knew it couldn't possibly work. And I was wondering, what in hell are America's diplomats doing? The experts on the world, why are we not getting the message across that this policy makes no sense? But I didn't say anything. I sat down at my typewriter and started to write a dissent channel message to explain why I thought the policy made no sense. But frankly, I knew I wasn't going to be listened to. I was in Greece then. I was a political counselor in Athens. I knew pretty much what America needed to know about Greece, but I was not, technically speaking, an expert on the Middle East. I didn't have any standing to protest the policy. But that said, I knew it was crazy. Over time, I just got more and more depressed with the work I was doing. I had an ambassador who was loyally looking after his own career. His philosophy and mine, you know, were different. That conflict made life a little more difficult. I was having bureaucratic problems. I was more interested, let's say, in talking to the Greeks than I was in talking to my colleagues. And frankly, their opinion matters more to my career than the opinion of the Greeks does. Mm-hmm. And I didn't look after my career enough. At a certain point, I blew up at something. It was something pretty small and bureaucratic, but I got angry enough at the ambassador and the embassy and the bureaucratic rigmarole that I finally asked myself, is what I'm doing serving my happiness or the welfare of the American people? And when the answer to both of those is no, I decided it was time to quit. And that decision, you know, it never occurred to me in 20 years ever, any of the times that I had disagreed with U.S. policy. Still, you know, I loved the job. I was doing something useful. At this point, I suddenly had this, you know, liberating moment. If I quit, I can go public and say what I genuinely feel about the direction America is going. And, you know, I sat down, wrote my letter, and it was a good feeling. And, you know, it was a liberating moment. And I think, at least I like to think, that I did some good.
So you wrote a letter to Secretary of State Colin Powell.
That's right, a three-page letter of resignation. Whenever a diplomat resigns, the protocol says you write a resignation letter to the Secretary of State. Mm. Normally he doesn't read it, but I wrote a letter that I was damn sure he was going to have to read it. I put sort of my heart into it. I put everything I'd learned in 20 years as a diplomat into saying, look, since World War II, the United States had made itself the leader of the free world, you know, a superpower that accomplished great things and made the American people safer than any people has ever been in history. And we are screwing it up. We are destroying this network of relationships that kept us safe. We're alienating our friends, and no good will come of it, and we will make a mess out of Iraq. And I sent that in, and then, you know, a couple days later, I sent it to the New York Times through a friend, and went on the internet and made me briefly a celebrity.
We have a caller waiting, but I want to, you know, sort of establish a bit more of the story before we go on and talk with some listeners. You mentioned a dissent channel in the State Department, and I guess I'm really curious, as I read during this period of time, I was reading Seymour Hersh, I was reading in the New York Times and various other publications, that there was dissent going on. There was, you know, there were a bunch of people in the State Department who didn't feel that the war was the correct direction, or if they were going along with the war, that there needed to be some planning for after the war, and from what I read, those people were essentially pushed aside. But I wonder if you could talk about that. To what extent is there, you know, a diversity of views in the State Department, and to what extent are those views heard?
One of the really good things of the Clinton administration was a determination to have a State Department that looked like America. And I think we really do have that, both in terms of ethnic diversity, gender diversity, and philosophical diversity. And you need that because the world is an incredibly diverse place, and someone like me does a very good job in a left-leaning country like Greece. I was able to establish rapport with Greek politicians and journalists really, really well. I would have been much less effective talking to German right-wingers, for example. But we have people who can talk to them really well. We have Cuban-American hardcore conservatives who can deal with, you know, a Colombian death squad leader brilliantly. I exaggerate a little bit there. But I mean, we have the people it takes to talk to anybody in the world, and this is an incredible asset for us. So we have all the political views represented. The ethos, though, I mean, the culture of the State Department is based on loyalty. In any large organization, it has to be. You fight the fight, and then when you lose, you follow out the policy, and you follow the policy. And pretty much the State Department is conditioned to that. We have a really good institutional mechanism called the dissent channel. Any Foreign Service employee of any rank can sit down at his word processor and write a telegram or a memo which will go to the Secretary of State's office. And you can say, you know, this is why our policy is wrong. This is what we need to do to fix it. You can send that in. Nobody can stop you from sending it in. It will be read. And if your boss punishes you for sending it in, your boss will be disciplined and he could even be fired. And the system works fairly well. But in the case of Iraq, there was, I think, a perception in the State Department that Colin Powell was fighting the best fight he knew how for a sensible policy. He was losing. Our complaining to Powell about the policy was not going to do very much good. He already knew, but our whining in the background would just be used by the conservatives in the Pentagon and other places to say the State Department is full of disloyal liberals and therefore you should ignore them completely.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can answer this, but I can't resist asking it. As you alluded, Colin Powell himself had a different view than a lot of the, I'd say, you know, more, I think, fairly call them hawkish people in the Defense Department, you know, Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld and so forth. I think that much was clear from reading what was going on at the time. Yet, he gave the address at the United Nations presenting the case for war with Iraq, laying out the evidence, which we now know was not correct, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Powell was in a difficult position because he was a conservative. He fully believed that Saddam was a danger to the world who ought to be gotten rid of. In that, he was a little off, but you know, it was intellectually a place you could understand how he got there. He told the president that fixing Iraq is not as easy as it looks. Are you sure you want to do this? When the president, you know, told him the decision is made, you know, we are going to take out Saddam Hussein, Powell was a good soldier, and he said, "All right, how do we limit the damage to U.S. interests from this decision?" And he said correctly, which what the British had been saying, if we get United Nations backing for this, the United States can invade Iraq and it will not cost us too much with our allies and friends. He made the best effort he could to get that U.N. backing. The task was impossible because we did not have the evidence to convince people. He gave it an amazing try. He sacrificed the personal credibility built up over 30 or 40 years on that one speech. You know, he had made a reasonable effort to vet the material to make sure that it was correct. It wasn't good enough, though. I mean, he was and the CIA basically did not play in good faith. They did not say everything they knew. If they had, he would not have said quite what he said. The end result was he sacrificed himself and his personal prestige in a failed effort to reduce the cost of a bad policy.
We have a call to talk with. Let's do that. Let me just reintroduce our guest this morning is John Brady Kiesling. He served for 20 years as a Foreign Service officer in the U.S. Department of State, and he resigned that position in 2003 in protest of the coming war with Iraq. And that's what we're talking about. If you'd like to join us, we have one caller waiting and time for others. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have a listener on line number four. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
I don't know if you can speak to this because I don't know the parameters when you quit a government job, particularly a diplomat, what can be done to you if you divulge things. But on a personal level, when I found out I was on the program today, I thought of the in the British system, it's sort of traditional for diplomats to do this sort of thing, and you know, it's sort of a mark that one can carry later on that sets them aside from other people who rush into things. I don't think it's particularly that way in our country, but I was concerned about the repercussions, particularly from this administration, who seems not to really care too much about what they do to people's lives. And, of course, the case in point is the person who spoke against the war, and the next thing you know, his wife was outed, you know, rather deliberately and with fanfare and all that sort of thing. And I was wondering if those sort of things have been aimed at you, or whether there's more subtle ways they can stop you from doing things, or whether or not they're just leaving you alone and hoping that things will just subside and they won't have to worry about the thorn in their side from you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the question. The short answer is, when I resigned, the State Department took the high road. They basically said, he's resigned. It was his personal decision to resign. We have no comment. I heard from friends that other people were thinking, you know, it would be good to do something to, you know, to say he's just a wacko. But they were smart enough to know that the sensible thing to do is to ignore me. And usually the Bush White House has been very good at ignoring people. And certainly in the run-up to the war, a lot of the American media very patriotically fell into line with the idea that if we don't agree with it, it's not news. So I suffered no repercussions. I have Foreign Service friends who are a little careful in talking to me because some of their bosses might hold it against them. But there's, you know, the U.S. government is not as scary with ordinary American citizens as some of us fear. Ordinarily, citizens have rights. Ashcroft crossed the line a couple of times. I mean, the Jose Padilla case, for example. But by and large, we have not reached a point where ordinary Americans need to be afraid that the government is going to come and do something bad to them. And that's something to remember. We can take a deep breath and say, the idiots in Washington who got us into Iraq are perfectly decent, ordinary, patriotic Americans. The only way we can convince them they're wrong is by recognizing that they are perfectly ordinary, decent Americans and engaging them as moral human beings. And I'm hoping that they're actually figuring out that they made a mistake, and they won't admit it, but they figured it out, and gradually they're changing American policy.
We have a caller I'll get to in just a second, but I wanted to ask you about something you spoke a great deal about last night, and that's the subject of legitimacy. And basically, what I got from your experience and insight and discussion of this is that really our power around the world is based on our perceived legitimacy in our relationships with other nations.
Yes.
What does that mean?
The problem with the world is that everybody is nationalistic and territorial. Americans will never tolerate for an instant any foreigner coming in and telling them how to live their lives. When Americans go into Greece or any other country in the world and tell the foreigners, this is the right way to do things, this is how we do it in our country, it's not just the instinctive reaction of people to say, go to hell. It is their patriotic duty to say that, because people judge themselves by their ability to protect their personal and national sovereignty against outsiders. The United States has to face the fact that for the rest of the world, we are outsiders. Outsiders can have influence under very specific circumstances. You can hold a gun to someone's head and make them do something, but it's really expensive and it doesn't work very well. Usually when you hold a gun to someone's head, instead of loyally going out and doing what you ask them to do, they sort of crumple into a ball and cry, you know, and start weeping and say, don't shoot me. We do not want states that go limp. We saw what happened when Haiti went limp. You know, a whole country turned into a disaster. In some ways, Iraq has gone limp. I mean, the government cannot govern. Ordinary people cannot live their lives because the system has broken down. If we had legitimacy, if ordinary Iraqis accepted that the United States had the right to give orders, you know, then it would be easy. You know, we'd say, okay, Iraqis, pull up your socks and get to work, and they would do it. Mm-hmm. But we don't. In fact, when we say pull up your socks and get to work, they, you know, their instinct and everything else says, you know, either do nothing or pick up a Kalashnikov. This is the reality of the world. You can deal with it. There are sources of legitimacy. The United States cannot give orders, but under certain circumstances, if we're waving a United Nations flag, we can tell people to do some kinds of things. If we are allies of a country, we can ask them to do some kinds of things and they will do it. There are other categories of influence that we can have that make our requests or suggestions or orders legitimate to other people. But in Iraq, we didn't have them, and we're not going to find a source of legitimacy.
We'll hopefully be able to follow up on that. There's many other questions related. We have some callers, and I want to include them in our conversation. In fact, our lines are almost full. We'll go first or next to Whiteheath listener on line number one. Good morning.
Hi, I'm just calling because of Secretary Powell and how he, you know, he might have hurt his own reputation, but he did a lot more than that. From my point of view, he went in front of the United Nations and literally told lies that he's always held up as, oh, he was a loyal soldier. Well, he was not a loyal soldier from my point of view. He was supposed to be loyal to the country, not to some person, not to his president. And I just can never forgive him for how he let down the country and showed, just destroyed our reputation in front of the United Nations. I don't think he can ever live that down. And I just, you know, when does loyalty... He was supposed to be loyal to his country, not to some president and some policy. That's where he really destroyed himself, from my point of view. I don't know. It was so disappointing because I always respected him up to that point.
Okay, well.
His case is tragic. And to be fair to Powell, he believed that he had done due diligence. He had gone to the CIA and looked at the material and thrown out most of it. And he hoped that what he was saying was true. He was not foolish enough. He was a good diplomat. Good diplomats do not tell knowing lies. It's too expensive. But you're right. He, in that moment, damaged himself and damaged the country. And it would have been better if he had not been a good soldier. People who defend him, and it's a legitimate defense, say that he was a very good diplomat. He managed to reduce the harm of our Iraq policy, certainly with a number of our allies. Rumsfeld in particular had been catastrophic in the things he said to alienate people all over the world. every time Rumsfeld would say something stupid and aggressive, Powell would go on and make a phone call and smooth things over. And, you know, I mean, it was good for the country that we had someone of that caliber who could do that. The net result was bad, but I try to, you know, God will have to decide about Powell, but, you know, there was good and bad and right and wrong in his choices.
A quick follow-up, and then we'll get to some more listeners' questions. The issue of the distortion of intelligence was raised in your resignation letter. I think many people were questioning the legitimacy of the evidence. And, you know, and I'm not trying to simply, you know, pile on Colin Powell because, you know, that's not going to, you know, help anyone. But it does seem like there were enough questions raised about the intelligence for any reasonable person who really considered this like a vital issue to bring that to the fore, and it just didn't happen. You know, it didn't happen, at least in the decision making in this case.
Yes, that's correct. The problem with the intelligence was that a number of people were feeding us material that was worthless. Chalabi is the most famous one. Ahmed Chalabi, the leader of the Iraqi National Congress, an exile who. He was the son of the largest Shiite landowner in Iraq, and he wanted to come back and triumph and be a warlord there. And he manipulated us very well. His organization found defectors and coached them on what to say. And the defectors didn't need very much coaching because the problem was any Iraqi who leaves Iraq and wants to be resettled in the United States – the only way he will be resettled is if he can tell something interesting to the CIA. And the problem is the CIA was interested in only one thing, which is the evidence of Saddam's weapons programs. And a defector who told the truth, which is that Saddam destroyed all of that stuff very grudgingly and unhappily in 1991, that guy is not going to be resettled. He's going to be shipped back to a refugee camp to rot. The only person who's going to be rewarded with a nice house in Southern California is the guy who can come up with a story that is credible, that somehow documents that Saddam has these prohibited weapons. And we managed to essentially teach the Iraqis exactly what stories to tell to get them the reward of an apartment, you know, in Southern California. And it's really bad intelligence technique, but the CIA was so under so much political pressure to come up with evidence that they took shortcuts, made mistakes. And then, of course, you have the Pentagon, a special office whose job is to find all of the raw intelligence reports that serve Rumsfeld's program and funnel them to the office of Vice President Cheney so Cheney can wave them in front of the president and say, "We've got the smoking gun on this guy now." And, you know, being an intelligence analyst it takes training. It takes years of training to know what's good and what's not. And the President of the United States is not trained to deal with raw intelligence. He has no business being shown this stuff because he can't interpret it properly. And no president can. But Rumsfeld played a very clever game.
We have several callers waiting. We'll go next to an Urbana listener on line number 2. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm just glad you're being interviewed. Another plus for WILL. Do you think that Condoleezza Rice is qualified to be Secretary of State? I got a couple of other questions, too.
She's a very disciplined, energetic woman who understands the instincts of her boss, the president, very well. She was a disaster as national security advisor because she saw her job as being to package the policymaking process so it flattered the president's instincts.
Okay.
And that's as good management upward, but it's really lousy policymaking.
Okay.
But as Secretary of State, she is now in a different role. And because she has the confidence of the president, she has the freedom which Powell didn't have to use the only resource she's got, which is the expertise of her diplomats. And she is using that reasonably well on a number of issues. For example, in North Korea, we've for the first time in 4 years gotten serious about diplomacy, and it's had some good results. I find that it's hopeful. Intellectually, she's not on a par with Powell. In terms of, you know, character, I would have preferred Powell. But in terms of her freedom to use the State Department for what it's good at, she has an advantage.
Recently, I heard that Ron Suskind, who wrote the book on former Treasury Secretary Riley, has said that a unnamed higher up in the Bush administration has said that the administration is a government idea of ideas, not of facts, and the ideas will lead and dominate any other person trying to make an argument for factual policy in any area. Now, that's a pretty broad statement, but how do you feel about it?
It certainly was true in the first 4 years. Whether it's true now, I'm not sure. In foreign policy, essentially, they charged headlong with their ideological crusade. They hit a brick wall. They picked themselves up, shook themselves off, and are looking around for a new direction to go. I'm not writing off the future of American diplomacy. I think there's some hopeful signs. On economic policy and energy policy, it doesn't seem that they're learning much. But we'll see what Rita does to their thought processes, and maybe it will focus them.
I hope the caller will forgive me, but we have several people waiting, and I want to include as many people as we can before we run out of time. We're talking this morning with John Brady Keesling. He served for 20 years as a Foreign Service Officer in the U.S. Department of State. He resigned that position in early 2003 in protest of the coming war in Iraq. And we're talking with him on Focus 580. Let me mention again, he'll be speaking at noon today at the University YMCA on the campus here. 10001 South Wright Street. That's free and open to the public. That's the Friday Forum Lecture. I think it gets started about 12:15, so you have time to get over there if you'd like to. Meanwhile, we'll carry on and speak with someone in Champaign next on line number 3. Good morning.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'd like to take up your suggestion that the Bush administration policy is crazy, that it's a mistake done by idiots. I think he used all these terms in describing what's got us into Iraq. It seems to me that, you know, this is just wrong. The Bush policy, which in fact has been largely successful, was to establish more or less permanent bases in the midst of the world's greatest energy-producing region as a method of control. Now, the control of Middle East energy has been a cornerstone of American policy literally for generations. I mean, the Eisenhower administration described it as the greatest material prize in the world, and the question was how to control that prize. And I do insist that it's control, not access, that's at stake here. I mean, the oil will flow regardless. But it's control of that oil and when it flows and how it flows that the U.S. has been interested in, not indeed even for our own uses, but as a way of dealing with our real rivals in the world, that is the European economy and the economy of Northeast China. If we can turn the spigot of oil on and off, the spigot of energy on and off, we have a serious control over these rivals, and that's been American policy, as I say, for a number of administrations
okay.
for a long time.
I think we
in that regard, they've been perfectly successful.
I think we take your point. Let's get a reaction. What do you think?
A brilliantly provocative question. My answer to that is because of the nature of politics, because of the nature of nationalism, we only have control to turn off the spigot. We do not have control to keep it open full bore. We do not have the ability to create with U.S. military power a government that will, in a docile manner, keep the energy flowing. In fact, the presence of U.S. bases is a guarantee that whatever government is there will be seen by a dangerously large part of its population as illegitimate. And that, you know, the fact that politically our presence in Saudi Arabia was unsustainable was one of the reasons why Rumsfeld wanted us out of there. And so he wanted to get rid of the Iraqi threat. Actually, that was, sorry, Wolfowitz. And it was a valid argument. I'm not sure that we could make our presence sustainable in Iraq, and I'm not sure that that presence would do us any real good in the long-term battle for energy. For energy, really, the only thing that protects us is our ability to generate enough money to pay for the oil.
Yeah, I think, in fact, all the U.S. has wanted to be able to do is to turn that spigot off. I mean, the U.S., for U.S. industry's purposes, we have all sorts of other sources of oil, including domestic oil and oil in the Western Hemisphere, notably Venezuela. That's one reason why we've been encouraging coups in Venezuela and make sure we have a government we like there.
Yeah, well, that's possible. I haven't seen that in my own experience as a diplomat that we've operated on those preconditions. But it's possible, but I would say not proven.
Okay. Hope the call will forgive me. We have several people waiting, and we're really moving into our last maybe 12 or 13 minutes. And I want to just, before we run out of time, ask you to talk about something that you spoke to last night. Obviously, the situation in Iraq is very grave, and I think you described it essentially as a complete, you know, Iraq is a shambles, is a quote. And I think that if you look at the major media, you don't quite get that because we're at such a remove and maybe not viewing things as intimately as we might. But my question is this. You spoke about the possibility of civil war in Iraq, and I think you said that really, it's not a question of if there will be a civil war in Iraq. It's a choice between civil wars in Iraq with us there, or if we withdraw, then without us, just to be a different kind of war.
Yeah, I'm afraid that's true. I'm not enough of an expert on the details of Iraqi tribal dynamics to explain what is going on. However, as far as I can tell, the experts we do have, the people who are sitting on the ground there, are not able to explain what is really going on either. It is simply too complicated. There are too many local power struggles happening, too many fluid alliances being made between groups with very different aspirations. And, you know, Zarqawi's little, you know, crazed religious group makes opportunistic alliances with Shiites, you know, with Ba'athists whose ideological views are 180 degrees removed from theirs. The presence of the U.S. troops forces certain groups to ally against us. If we leave, they will split up and they may start fighting each other. But what is better for the Iraqi people in this, I really can't say. My gut tells me we should get out, but I can't make an informed calculation.
Okay. Well, we have another listener waiting on line number 2 in Urbana. Good morning.
Yeah, I'm disheartened at the terrible quagmire of this situation, but I think one of the few bright spots is that we did eliminate a multi-billionaire, Hussein, who, if he didn't have weapons of mass destruction, he was seeking them. And Hal Lindsey even suggested that his WMDs may have been shuttled across to Syria. So I think that's one of the few bright spots. Would you comment?
It's definitely a bright spot that Saddam Hussein is not with us. He was a criminal, mostly to his own people, but also in, you know, he killed, you know, a million Iranians. He murdered lots of Kuwaitis. I dream of a world in which the United Nations will authorize the senior members such as ourselves to intervene to rid the world of people like that. But we cannot do it ourselves unless the world accepts the need to do it. And the problem is Saddam Hussein was not a madman. Saddam Hussein in 1991 looked around and said, damn, I cannot maintain an arsenal of weapons of mass destruction because it's too dangerous. He destroyed his arsenal. And we know actually exactly what happened to his arsenal. The UN inspectors did a pretty good job, and then the American survey team that came in afterwards that turned the country inside out. And you know, we know the whole process by which very slowly, grudgingly, he got rid of the stuff and then tried to hide how far he had gotten. Yes, he hoped someday in the future, when UN sanctions were over, when he was back in the good graces of the international community, he'll go back and keep Iraq on the map of regional powers by having a real serious military, which would probably include some prohibited weapons. But he was a rational man, and he would only do it when it was safe to do it. And we as the United States and the international community had made sure that it would never be safe for him to do it. The UN sanctions had worked. The UN inspections had worked. We had shut him down. And we could have done it indefinitely, and we could have done it and lifted sanctions to allow the Iraqi people to live a little better. So it was overkill on our part.
How could we have done it indefinitely if he could have got some plutonium or uranium and made a dirty bomb? I mean, it wouldn't take that much to really make a tremendous WMD out of a dirty bomb. You wouldn't need a thermonuclear device.
Well, that's true of any university campus in the country. Making a dirty bomb – actually, making a dirty bomb that kills people is very hard because radiation is not a very effective weapon. It's a weapon of fear, not a weapon for killing people. But that said, yes, theoretically Saddam could do it. The question is, what political purpose does it serve him to – frighten the hell out of New York City when what it will do is cause his country to be turned into a parking lot? You know, the trade-off makes no sense to him. He was a rational man whose thought as a rational dictator was to stay as dictator and pass the country on to his sons. And, you know, simple blind malice at the U.S. is something that a dictator can't afford. You know, he's got more important things to worry about.
We have just about maybe 9 minutes left with our guest, John Brady Kiesling. He resigned from the U.S. Department of State in 2003 in protest of the war, coming war in Iraq at that time. And if you want to join us in the time remaining, you're welcome to do so, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. I want to spend a little time talking about how we get out of this particular situation. And I think one of the hopeful things you suggested last night is that the world still has an interest in American legitimacy. They really want us to be a moral superpower. How would we reestablish legitimacy that we have lost in recent years?
Several steps to take. The world needs the United States because of our unique ability to apply power quickly at a distance with relatively good surgical precision. And that's a very useful skill. And we also have money, which helps. The Europeans, though, will not accept us as legitimate unless they perceive that our values and their values, our interests and their interests, are reasonably parallel. They will only accept it if they think we're reasonably competent and if the intervention we plan is something that ordinary people will see as moral. And, you know, we can do that. One of the big holes we dug for ourselves was the way we tried the way we walked away from the Kyoto Protocol. We didn't have to implement the protocol, but we had at least to tell the world that, yes, we agree that climate change is a really major issue and we're going to work together. President Bush dropped the ball in the way he handled that. He's now saying better things. What I would hope is that Katrina gives him the political window to go and tell the American people, you know, climate change is too dangerous. We've got to suck it up, make some sacrifices, change our policy, start moving toward a Kyoto-style regime, and not Kyoto itself, but in that direction. If he does that and does it credibly, that will convince a lot of Europeans, hey, America is not completely on the lunatic fringe on the environment. If he pushes a little harder on the Middle East peace process, he gains us some legitimacy with the Islamic world, which we badly need. If he, the United States has actually been pretty generous in Africa, relatively speaking. We can work with that more. We need to make another big effort. We need to spend the money we promised, and that's hard because we're broke at the moment. But with things like that, and if the problem with President Bush is people make their judgments based on perceived character. Most Europeans at the moment have written off the character of President Bush as alien to their values. It's very hard for him now to claw his way out of that, but it might be possible. And, you know, there are other spokesmen for the U.S. government who can come across as these highly principled, sincere, humane, humanistic people who can establish these bonds with the Europeans again. So with good diplomacy and with a few policy shifts, we can get back in the international mainstream. When we're in the international mainstream, then automatically we lead.
Now, essentially, you're talking about a return to a commitment to international organizations and international law.
That's right. When we trash the United Nations, we shoot ourselves in the foot. I mean, the United Nations is it's not an efficient organization. It's full of time-serving career bureaucrats who are just interested in their next meal, a lot of them. But that is the price we pay for the service the United Nations provides. And what the United Nations gives us is a beautiful blue flag under which the United States and its friends, when it's necessary, can go into some foreign country and tell them what to do. With that flag, we can do it affordably. Without that flag, it costs us simply too much, and we can do it once or twice, but very many Iraqs and the country's bankrupt.
We have actually our lines are basically full, and we only have about 3 minutes left. I'm sorry about that, but we will continue on and talk with someone in Kankakee. Next, line number one. Good morning.
Your caller would wish to praise the guest for his courage, patriotism, and understanding, and inquire as to what the citizens of the United States should be doing, leaning on Congress and the administration to be doing right now. Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
That is the question. I think my instinct tells me that the American people have to tell their members of Congress, we are a brave people. We are a people who will accept sacrifice for the long-term future of our country. We will do what it takes. We will adapt a reasonable energy policy. We will make lifestyle changes. We will become a country that can afford to spend money in the service of the world at large. And if we tell Congress that we are in fact the people that we think we are, I mean, generous, brave, willing to bear burdens in the interests of a more stable, prosperous world. If we do that, maybe Congress will get the message and stop building bridges to nowhere in Alaska and start spending money where it counts on the long-term sustainable economic future of the country.
We have just about a minute and a half left. I'm going to try to squeeze in one last call, and that's someone in Bloomington, line number four. Good morning. Hello? I guess that person isn't there. Next, we'll go to Charleston, line number two. Good morning.
Hi. We were in Europe this summer during the lead-up to the French vote on the EU Constitution and afterwards, and from the people in the coffee houses to the talking heads on the TV, universally, they were saying and precluding every statement with, now that the United States has abdicated its political and moral leadership in the world, who's going to fill the vacuum? And as a U.S. citizen in Europe, it was a rather unnerving experience. I'm not sure what we can do. We're already irrelevant in the eyes of the world.
We're not irrelevant. We are, at the moment, an unknown quantity. The world is looking at the United States, wondering whether we just went through a temporary bad patch or whether we've just sort of become an aging, frightened empire, just jealous of its old glories. And, you know, we have to go back and tell the Europeans, we are still here. We are still the America of hope, of progress, of promise, of opportunity. The problem is they won't believe our rhetoric. We have to, you know, we've used the rhetoric for years and people are tired of rhetoric. We actually have to change our behavior, be a little braver, a little smarter, a little stronger, do our homework. And, it's not hopeless. We're in much better shape than the European Union to lead the world because we're one relatively strong, legitimate, disciplined government which can get things done better than 25 scattered governments can.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, but I will suggest for folks, if you'd like to hear more on the topic from our guest, John Brady Kiesling, he'll be speaking today at noon in just about an hour at the University YMCA, 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign on the campus of the University of Illinois. That's the Friday Forum Lecture Series. That is free and open to the public, so you should certainly feel free to attend. And meanwhile, we'll just have to leave it there for this hour, and thanks so much for being here.
Thanks a lot, Jack.